Now, if you look around your home, you'll probably see a lot of different items. Some are there because you need them to do something for you. Think a toaster, a bed, some dishes. And then there are other items that remind you of happy times, like shells collected on a vacation or photos of family members, books that you read as a child, and then maybe to your own kids. And maybe there are some things that cover a few different categories, like a new smartphone that replaced the one that was still working, but you really wanted a newer, fancier model. The stuff we own can be comforting, or it can be overwhelming, a source of pride, or even a source of stress. And that's because we form relationships to things that aren't that different from the ones we form with other people. We want to hear from you during this conversation. You can call us at 800-642-1234. How much do you think about the stuff around you? And how does it make you feel? 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Our guest is Christine Harold. She's a professor of communication at the University of Washington. She is author of Our Space, Resisting the Corporate Control of Culture. And her newest book is titled Things Worth Keeping, The Value of Attachment in a Disposable World. Christine, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
You are interested in how and why people form attachments to inanimate objects. What are the different reasons that we connect with things and then hold them dear?
Yeah, it's a great question. And obviously, it's multifaceted. And of course, designers and advertisers are very much invested in getting us to attach to objects for a variety of reasons. But some reasons have to do with, you know, those meaningful sentimental objects that invoke memories of a loved one or of a great experience. Other objects we just feel express our identity in some way, like maybe we're really into a particular kind of sneaker, or, you know, this particular backpack conveys to other people that I'm into skating, or I'm, you know, this or that. Other things are just pleasurable at a tactile level, right? We like the way that they feel, the way that they look. Other things are just simply useful. They have a function. Those oftentimes aren't the ones that we attach to in an emotional way quite as much, a little bit more easily replaced. But there's a pretty wide variety, and it can get complicated pretty quickly.
So it's not always necessarily a natural attachment. There are people and businesses invested in us forming these connections.
Absolutely. But for the most part, I would say most mainstream, you know, marketers for large corporate retailers, for example, they're less interested often in getting us to form a lasting bond with objects. In fact, they would often be pretty much the opposite, right? That they're interested in that moment, that first moment of attraction, right? You see something on the store shelf in Target or hanging on, you know, hanging in a department store or something, and you think, oh, I want it, that desire moment of attraction. In fact, a lot of companies precisely don't want that to last, right? That if they're going to sell more stuff, then that initial moment of attraction needs to fade. And so that you're enticed kind of with the next thing. But there are a lot of designers and activists and artists and, you know, sort of everyday makers who are really trying to promote a mode of design and engagement with objects where that connection is sustained, right? Where we are more reluctant to throw something away, or if we are done with it, we'll be more thoughtful about what we do with it when we're done. Maybe we'll pass it on to somebody else, or we'll see that it gets appropriately recycled. So there's lots of ways in which there's lots of opportunities right now for us to be more thoughtful stewards of the things in our lives.
And that's in contrast to this idea that items are made to be disposable, or that it's okay to replace them just because we're tired of them, or there's a new style, a new model available. That's a relatively recent concept, at least to the general public. What's leading us to that?
To the disposable model?
Yeah, to the idea that it's okay to just replace things whenever we want.
Yeah, absolutely. The word consume used to really have a very different connotation really not that long ago. So 100 years ago, to consume something was to really exhaust its usefulness, right? That you would wear the thing until it was threadbare. And even then you would darn your socks, right? Or you would repair things, right? When's the last time you saw a television repair shop, for example? Our sensibility nowadays is just that you chuck it and you move on to the next model. And there's a whole, obviously a whole communicative apparatus in place of advertising and marketing and lifestyle blogs and magazines and so on that are all about getting us to covet the new and the next one. And I cite in the book a scholar named Jonathan Chapman who says, landfills are filled with toasters that still toast and refrigerators that still refrigerate. Their only crime being that they sort of lost that the relationship went south, right? It maybe the exterior looked dated. It didn't go with our new appliances, and so on. So I think that there's just this tendency to, that always to strive for that next thing. There's all kinds of ways in which that's being interrupted right now.
Like what?
Well, I mean, I think I should say pre-COVID, and I have some things to say about that, but pre-COVID even, there's a lot of, as I say, people who are engaging in something called emotional design, right? Like emotionally durable design, trying to create things like clothes and furniture that take on like a particular sheen, or, a coffee table that, say, invites dents and stains, so that you can see, oh, that's where my coffee cup sits every morning. And you can kind of see that on the table, or there's where my 3-year-old ran his matchbox car across the surface, right? So that thing becomes a text of sorts that kind of tells a story. And it becomes a little bit more imprinted with us and more of a memento, and maybe less likely to end up being cast away just because Pottery Barn came out with a new model.
That makes me think of a table that I have that's my grandpa's grandparents, and there's this particular nick in it, right, that's a deep gouge that they wanted to fix when we had it restored. And it was like, no, there's a story there. Don't touch it. And so those sorts of things are kind of the things I think I hear you talking about.
Yes, absolutely. And of course, retailers also get this. And so we have a lot of things that are new in the shops that have kind of a distressed finish for furniture, or pre-faded jeans, or t-shirts that look vintage when really they just, are on the, were bought at Target and so on. So that is being reproduced. That kind of faux vintage is very popular. But I think you're right that especially those items where you know the story behind that gash, or those jeans that are perfectly kind of melded to your body over time because of many years of wear, that those things become meaningful in ways that can't really be reproduced necessarily. Mm-hmm.
We're talking with Christine Harold, who wrote the book, Things Worth Keeping, The Value of Attachment in a Disposable World. You're part of this conversation. Call now at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like you form attachments to some or maybe all of your possessions? Or maybe this has been a time when you have decided to get rid of some things that you thought meant a lot to you. 800-642-1234. We have time for your call. And Christine, I want to let you talk a little bit about how you think our relationship to things has changed as we have been dealing with COVID-19.
Yeah, it's really interesting that so much of our lives have changed. Either people are working from home, those of us that are fortunate enough to have jobs where we can relatively easily work from home. Others of us have become unemployed or employed differently in all kinds of ways. So you see, the trends that I identify in the book, some of them have really intensified during this time of quarantine. So one, for example, is I write in the book a chapter on that's in part about Marie Kondo, which your listeners are probably familiar with her very popular book, The Lifestyle or The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up. And she has a Netflix series on the same subject. But people decluttering their homes has just intensified during quarantine, right? So you even have a phrase for it, Corona cleaning, they call it. Or Goodwill in Los Angeles had to take out a series of ads asking people to stop bringing stuff to the Goodwill because they couldn't accommodate all of the stuff that was coming to them because people were stuck at home and they were cleaning out closets and so on. You also see an intensification of crafting and DIY projects and people making things at home. Of course, there's like the sourdough bread trend that I didn't participate in, but I hear a lot about, or just people taking up old hobbies or starting new ones. I also think people are shopping less or shopping differently than they were before. Now, these things might change, obviously, when we're back in person. But I'm not sure. I mean, I do think there's a repatterning happening right now of our consumer practices that's pretty interesting. And I think has some potential, this pause that we're taking in life in all kinds of ways, has a potential to maybe change things at least a bit, I think, going forward.
We're talking with Christine Harold about her book called Things Worth Keeping, The Value of Attachment in a Disposable World. She's a professor of communication at the University of Washington. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. What story do you want to share? We're continuing this conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina. We are talking about the attachments we form to objects and why they can actually be there's a positive way to counter our throwaway consumer culture. Our guest is Christine Harold, who is talking about her book called Things Worth Keeping, The Value of Attachment in a Disposable World. She is a professor of communication at the University of Washington. And Alex from Dodge County wants to join the conversation. Welcome, Alex. Hi, Alex. All right. We might have lost Alex, but it looks like we do have Patrick in Wausau ready to talk with us. Patrick, are you there?
Yes, ma'am.
Hey, welcome to the conversation. What's on your mind?
Well, so my wife and I downsized about a year ago, and this topic is quite timely. Right now, I'm becoming good friends with Facebook Marketplace, and I'm glad to be able to sell some of our stuff rather than fill up the landfill.
Okay.
Matter of fact, I'm driving from my storage unit to my downsized home with a bistro table and a couple chairs that somebody's going to pick up tonight.
All right. Good timing indeed, Patrick. Thanks for sharing that with us. And Christine, Patrick, meeting people where they are for sure, as Patrick is dealing with the stuff that they've downsized instead of throwing it out, making sure that other people get it and, you know, maybe help pad the bank account a little bit.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's great. And so many people are downsizing for all kinds of reasons. And, you know, one of the kind of central arguments of the book is that so often, say, environmental activists will say, you know, if you care about the environment, you should stop shopping or care less about material things, right? That, or to be a better person, we're supposed to kind of cut ourselves off from that part of ourselves that loves things. And I'm actually arguing the opposite, that if we care about kind of the ethics of how things get made or the environmental impacts of where they go when we're done with them, then I'm arguing for us to care for things and love things more, not less, to be more materialistic in a sense. There's ways in which you might not have use for all of those things, but even if you have a sense of attachment or a sense of responsibility for them or an obligation to see that they go someplace productive, like to another home, then I think that's a real step in the right direction.
There's,
so that's great. Good luck, yep. Patrick.
Yes, indeed. It can be an endeavor for sure. You know, the title of your book is Things Worth Keeping. There's a lot in those three words. How do we choose things worth keeping?
Yeah, it's a really great question. So in the book, I break down a number of different ways that we value things. So getting at that word worth, what are things worth? And there are different ways in which we value things. So I talk about something called project value, and I'm riffing off of some work done by other scholars who have identified a term that they call the IKEA effect, where you might have a Billy bookcase in your living room, and it's only worth in dollars, maybe 80 bucks. I don't know, however much a Billy bookcase is, 100 bucks. But if you spent half a day with an Allen wrench and poring over those instructions and maybe even getting in a fight with your spouse over like, no, it's this part or, oh, you know, if you invest your time and sweat and effort into putting the thing together, it actually goes up in your estimation and how much you value it. They actually did a bunch of studies with college students where they would have them put together objects like a box from IKEA, and they would value the students would value the one that they put together higher than the exact same box that somebody else put together, right? So that's something that I talk about in the book as project value. There's also ritual value. Maybe you use the same coffee cup every morning, and it doesn't have to be an expensive, valuable in a monetary sense coffee cup. But if you use the same cup every day, it becomes imbued with meaning because you have ritualized its use. There's, you know, other things have kind of a memory value, that of course that it was, you know, maybe it's just a regular old JanSport backpack that you got at the store. It looks like a million others, but it's the one that went with you on that backpacking trip that was really meaningful to you. And so it becomes kind of irreplaceable, even though it's a mass produced object. So there's lots of ways that we can come to value things that those who designed them and those who sold them maybe never even anticipated.
That's so interesting that when we put work into something, it hits us a little bit more. What about the next generation, though? I think of it with family heirlooms that are passed down. If you didn't put the work into something or you didn't remember the stories from something, our relationship with those objects in those later generations, it changes.
Yeah, that's right. There's actually been stories about, you know, how parents are trying to pass down their 1980s oak furniture to their millennial children. And the children are like, I don't want that. Right. So there's certainly that component, but you know, there's some interesting projects being done by activists and artists that are really trying to work their way around exactly what you described. So there's a group in the UK, for example, that is putting QR codes on secondhand items. So if you donate some things, say to a Goodwill, you could record a little bit of yourself talking and saying, this was my prom dress. I wore it to my prom in 1995. And my date was called Billy so-and-so, and we had a great time, but I don't have use for it anymore. I hope you have fun with it. You know, just a little something, or inviting people to write a little note about, you know, some history of the object. Because objects have a life cycle just like we do. Somebody invented it. Somebody designed it. Somebody owned it for however many years. And so there's all kinds of ways in which we can kind of help imprint the object's life, right? And so I really like, it's just a small example, but Patagonia in their children's coats, on the little patch that says this coat belongs to, and it's a place for you to write your kid's name with a marker. They have 5 lines for names, which is just this little invitation to pass it on, right? So maybe it was owned by Jacob, and then it was owned by Paul, and then it was owned by Tyrese, right? And it just goes this notion that the object has a life above and beyond any one owner.
Well, and now we've circled all the way back to what we talked about in the beginning, the idea of creating a story or having a story, and how that adds to the allure of the things that we surround ourselves with.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Do you think our relationship with objects is inherently good, inherently bad? Does it even get one of those labels? How should we think about it?
No, I mean, I certainly don't think it's good or bad, and I'm not, it's they're different, right? But I do think that the way that we're invited by the mainstream of kind of the commercial persuasion industry, right? Marketing and advertising and so on, is understandably skewed toward the incessant upgrade, right? That pointed toe shoes were popular last year, this year it's rounded toes. Or last year it was pockets went this way, this year pockets go that way. Last year it was skinny jeans, next year, you know, I mean, I think that there's an understandable market-driven need to have us constantly being dissatisfied with the stuff we already have. So I do think that there are some obvious downsides to that model. But I don't think that our attachment or our connection with objects is good or bad. I think that there's all kinds of opportunities actually to deepen those connections and to capitalize on them. The fact that we care about stuff is an opportunity. I don't think it's a flaw.
Thank you so much for talking us through this. We know that we've just scratched the surface of your book, but we really appreciate your time today, Christine.
Oh, I appreciate you having me. Thank you so much.
Christine Harold is professor of communication at the University of Washington. She was with us to talk about her latest book called Things Worth Keeping: The Value of Attachment in a Disposable World. And you can still share your thoughts about your possessions and what kind of attachment you feel to them. Do you appreciate the items that work hard for you day after day? Maybe there are things that wouldn't mean anything to anyone else, but you have this strong emotional connection to them. Head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page and let us know about them. Share your story with us.